We're holding on page Tess in Yoma Os Yud Zayin. We were talking about the fire on the Mizbeach because we were talking about the various Nisim in the Beis Hamikdash, and among them was that the fire never was put out by the rain, and that the smoke of it was never dispersed by the wind. And we said, what smoke wasn't? Doesn't it say that one of the five things about this fire was that it didn't produce smoke? So we said there was the Eish Min HaHedyot that did produce smoke. And nevertheless, that smoke was never dispersed by the wind. At the end, by the way, when we mentioned the five things that were missing in the second Beis HaMikdash, Marsha points out, now there were actually other things later on in the Masechta when we talk about what happened to the Aron at the end of the first Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara mentions over there, according to the opinion that it was hidden away under the Beis HaMikdash, that together with it were hidden several other things, the jar with the mon and Aaron's staff and so forth. Here we're not listing those because here we're talking about things that were missing, as in therefore the second Beis HaMikdash functioned differently than the first one. The fact that there was no Oren, the fact that there was no Oren and the other things that go with it, the Kaporis and the Kruvim, the fact that there was no Shechina and therefore that the Urim V'Tumim didn't work and so forth, as opposed to, for example, that Aaron's staff is missing, that doesn't change the functioning of the Beis HaMikdash.
This is six. I'm sorry, the sixth one.
So we said Oren, Kaporis, and Kruvim is one, Eish is the second, Shechina is the third, yeah. Yeah, Oren, Kaporis, and Kruvim, Rashi says counts all as one, yeah. Okay, so Tana Rabbanan, we learn in a Braisa, Sheish Ishes Hein. There are six kinds of fire. Marsha points out that now there are three. We can talk about three levels of existence. Marsha often uses this explanation in different places in his Pirushim. You have our physical world, and then you have the world of the Galgalim, the world of the stars and planets and whatnot, and then you have the Ruchnis, the worlds. We're used to talking about four worlds, but those are all spiritual worlds. And then one of them within Asiya is our physical world. Here, Marsha is summarizing that you have our physical world, you have the heavenly world, and then you have the spiritual world. So each one, Ishos is the plural of Eish, fire. So there's three realms over there, and each one has two types, one associated with Chesed and one with Gvura. And therefore, the result is that there are six kinds of fire. Yesh eish echelos ve'en eshosa. There's a kind of fire that eats but doesn't drink, meaning that it burns solids, flammable solids, but not liquids. Yesh shosa ve'en echelos. Then there's the kind of fire that drinks, that consumes liquids but not solids. Yesh echelos ve'shosa. Then there's a kind that both eats and drinks. It consumes both solids and liquids. Yesh shosa or echelos lachen ki yaveshin. Another one is able to eat and consume moist things just as much as dry ones. Yesh eish doicha eish. Then there's a kind of fire that pushes away other fire. Yesh eish echelos eish. And there's a kind of fire that consumes other fire. So let's go through them. Yesh eish echelos ve'en eshoisa hodidan. Regular fire that we're familiar with is echelos ve'en eshoisa. You can burn flammable solids in it, but you can't burn water or other non-flammable liquids in it. Just the opposite, they'll put it out. Choice of the then you have the kind that drinks but doesn't eat, the kind of heat, the kind of fire in a person that has a fever. A feverish person is constantly thirsty, but on the other hand, he has no appetite. So therefore, in that sense, that fire can be described as it drinks, it consumes the liquid in his body, but it doesn't eat because it doesn't get fed with food. In fact, the Gemara in a different place mentions. The Gemara asks in Sanhedrin, where it deals with how the animals managed on the Teva for an entire year. So one question is, the lion, aren't lions carnivorous? So we're familiar with the explanation in Chassidus that for that year, the animals, that the lions ate grass just like they will in Moshe Mashiach. But the Gemara actually has an expression on it that the lion, at least for a period of time during the Mabul, was feverish and therefore that sustained it. It didn't need to eat because basically it's eating, it's living off. It's living off the fever, so therefore, so that fits with what we're saying in our Gemara.
How long would that be approximately?
Well, the whole Mabul lasted for an entire year. The fever didn't last for a whole year. You wouldn't have had any lions at the end of it. So, Pashto's the Gemara means that just for a period of time. Anyway, so then you have a kind of fire that eats and drinks equally. That would be Eliyahu. That would be the fire that came down on the Mizbeach for Eliyahu by Har HaCarmel. A fire from Hashem came down onto the Mizbeach. It consumed the korban oila and the wood and the stones of the Mizbeach and the dirt that had been used to put together the Mizbeach, and it even licked up and consumed all the water that was in the trench. You have in the Pesukim over there, it describes how after Eliyahu had placed the korban on the Mizbeach, he tells his Talmidim to fill up buckets and barrels of water and pour it on. And he dug a trench around there the size of the chotzer of the Mishkan, 50 by 100 amas, and the entire trench and the Mizbeach and everything was drenched with water. And then the fire came down and consumed all of it. Next. We said you have a kind of fire that can consume moist things as easy as dry ones. That is the Marocha. That's the fire of the Marocha. We said before they would put fresh limbs of Karbanos on it, and those in the first Beis Hamikdash, that is, and it would burn them just as easily as it burned the dry wood. Or we said also the wood itself sometimes would be moist and still it would burn just as easily. Yesh Eish Doicha Eish. The fifth kind of fire is fire that pushes away other fire. That is the Gavriel. That's the kind of fire of Gavriel. We learned at the end of Pesachim that when Hanani, Mishael, Azariah was thrown into the fire, and Gavriel goes to save them. And what does he do? He says, I'm going to heat up the oven on the outside and I'm going to cool it off on the inside. So, and when what happened, we learned over there that the Goyim, the soldiers who had thrown Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah into the furnace, they themselves were burnt by that intense heat. So Gavriel's fire pushed away the regular fire and cooled it down for them and intensified the fire on the outside for everybody else. And the sixth one, Vyesh Eish, then you have a kind of fire that consumes other fire, that is the Shechina, the fire of the Shechina. The Amma, we have in Gemara in Sanhedrin. The Gemara discusses over there that before Hashem created humanity, he consulted with the Malachim whether he should. This is one meaning of what it says, Nasa Adam, that Hashem showed on Nivus that even though he's Kol Yochel, he consulted with the Malachim ahead of time. And you had a group of Malachim who said, don't bother, because humankind is going to be full of Averis and lies and all kinds of other things. And the Gemara says, the Amma, who says in the Gemara over there, Hoshit Etzvoy B'neim Rasrafam, Hashem put his finger, so to speak, between them and burnt them, representing, in other words, that even a tiny little bit of a gilui of course of a level higher than the malachim could be completely mevatel them. So that was the malachim themselves are described as fire. So you have a fire that consumes that consumed them. Okay. So we said one of the nisim in the Beis Hamikdash was Vashana Marocha. We said the smoke that came from the Marocha, which we established, that means the smoke that comes from the Eish Min HaHedyot, from the human brought fire that was placed on the Mizbeach. So we said there was a nest that smoke was never dispersed by the wind. Afilo kol harucha shebo'olam bo'os v'nosh v'zgoi, even if all the winds in the world come and blow on it, in mezizos osin memkoimoi, they wouldn't move it from its place. The question is that so? So you're telling me it always was in a straight line going up. At the end of the last day of Sukkot, so the last day Yom Tov Achron Shochag means Shemini Atzeres. Now Rashi points out. Now we have the Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah that says Vachag Nidonin Alamoyim on Sukkot were judged about the water, about the rainfall for the coming year. So now the next day Shemini Atzeres, then people are looking to see what the weather forecast is for the coming year. Hakolt Sofin Bashana Marocha, everybody would be looking towards the smoke of the Marocha. So from Rashi's Loshin is Mashma that we're talking about that the judgment itself takes place on Shemini Atzeres, and then they're looking the night after that or the day after that on Yisro Chag. Another possibility is the Gemara may mean that the judgment itself takes place on Hashanah Rabbah. We know that, and that's why on Hashanah Rabbah we have a whole bunch of Hashanahs davening for rain, and then Matzo Yom Tov Achron would be as the Yom Tov is ending, as it's the day after Hashanah Rabbah. Everybody's looking, Hakolt Sofin Bashana Marocha, everybody would be looking at the smoke from the Marocha to see in which direction it's tilting. Nota Klapet Sofin. Now keep in mind, of course, a column of smoke, if it's going in one direction, it means the wind is coming from the opposite direction. If it's going towards the east, for example, it means the wind is coming from the west and so forth. Note a clap at Sofen if they saw that it was inclining towards the north. That so it means that you have a south wind, and it means the primary, the predominant winds during the next year are going to be from the south. Well, therefore, Aniyim Smechem, the poor people would be happy. Balabatim Atsevim, the Balabatim who sell produce are going to be upset. Because that means rainfall during that year is going to be plentiful. The south wind brings lots of rain. So now there's lots of rain. There won't be a drought. But what it means is there's so much rain that therefore, with all the rain and the humidity, fruit and produce won't keep for very long. So the poor people are happy because it means that the Balabatim have to sell things very quickly and at very cheap prices before it rots. The Balabatim, therefore, are upset because it means they're not going to be making much of a profit on their produce because they have to sell it quickly. Note to Klapid Dorim. On the other hand, if the smoke was turning towards the south, the other way around, Aniyim Atsevim, Rashidim Smechim. The other way around, the poor people are upset and the rich people are happy. Because the other way around, it means that year is going to be relatively little rain, or perasein mishtamrin. So there won't be too little rain, there won't be a drought, but there'll be little enough rain that there won't be much humidity. Therefore, the produce will stay fresh for a longer time. So therefore, the balabatim are happy; they can store it up and they can sell it when they want to, and they can charge higher prices for it. And because of that, the poor people are sad because it means that prices are going to be higher. Note to Klapim Mizrach Akol Smechim. If the column of smoke leaned towards the east, meaning that the wind is coming from the west, Akol Smechim, then everybody is happy. The west wind is a very balanced wind. It brings rain, but not too much. So you have not too much to cause the produce to spoil, and not too little that produce won't grow properly. So therefore, everybody's happy. It means the prices are going to be stable and normal. And if it leans towards the west, then everybody is sad because it means the east wind is blowing. The east wind, we find in many places throughout the Gemara, is a very hot. We find that even in Psukim, you have by Yonah, when he's sitting under the Kikoyan over there outside of Ninveh, says there was a Ruach Kodim. Actually, come to think of it in general, we have Ruach Kodim is always a harsh, strong wind. That was the one by the Kriyas Yamsuf. That was the one by Yonah. You have other psukim that also talk about Ruach Kodim being a drying wind, so then it dries everything out. Kodim is the Mizrach. So in other words, a wind that comes from the east and blows towards the west. So now if the wind is coming from the east and blowing towards the west, then it's a hot, dry wind, and therefore that year is going to be a year of drought. So everybody's upset. The Balabatim are not going to have much produce to sell, and the poor people, whatever there's going to be available to sell, is going to be at high prices. The point being, in other words, that we're saying that the column of smoke was not always rising up straight. It was going this way or that. The answer is to kayif or push it. It would bend and then it would straighten out. Or to ozel v'osi, or it would go back and forth. Kedikla, like a palm tree. A palm tree is basically standing straight, but it sways in the wind this way or that. The same way, the column of smoke would sway in the wind this way or that. The point of the nest was, though, that it didn't scatter. It didn't scatter and spread out. Right. Regular smoke will disperse in every direction as the wind blows. Here, the smoke stayed in one column, just that column itself would tilt in one direction or another, depending on the wind.
What determines the kind of wind you're going to get and the kind of year you're going to have? The avodah of the year?
Maybe it's avodah on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. I don't know. But whatever it is, the point is, since v'chag nidon al ha'moyim, since Hashem decides during Sukkot what the rainfall is going to be for the year, so therefore, immediately after that judgment is finalized, then you look and see which way the wind is blowing, and that gives you an idea what the forecast is going to be for the coming year. It would depend on the ma'isim of the Jewish people. The Gemara even mentions in Rosh Hashanah, you can have an example. It says, let's say, for example, during Tishrei, people were not on the level they were supposed to be. So therefore, Hashem decided that year is going to be relatively little rainfall. What happens then later in the year? They do tshuva. Hashem then makes it fine. The gzeira is not going to be changed. There'll still be very little rainfall, but Hashem will make sure that not a single drop of it goes to waste. Every bit of it that falls will fall on the fields and the orchards and the vineyards and whatnot, rather than any of it being wasted out in the mountains or whatever, and vice versa if they were good during Tishrei and then deteriorated afterwards. But the point is that now whatever the wind is going to be on Mitzvah Yom Tov Achan Shochag, we're saying is going to be the predominant wind for the coming year, for the coming rainy season at least, and therefore that would tell them how things are going to be. Anyway, so the Gemara says, Omamau, now we said, clapping Mizrach, I call Smechim, clapping Mayra, I call Atsevim. So you're telling me that when the column of smoke was turning toward, was tilting towards the east, then everybody was happy because it means there's west winds blowing, which are a good moderate wind. And on the other hand, we said when the smoke is going towards the west, meaning that the wind is coming from the east, then everybody was sad because that's a hot, dry, harsh wind. The question is, Raminu, I have a contradiction though. A Braisa says, Mizrachis la'olam yofa, just the opposite. The east wind is always good. Marovis la'olam kosher, the west wind is always bad. Ruach tzfonis yofa l'chitim b'shar shevir shlish, a north wind is good for the wheat when it's grown one third of its growth. But that same north wind is not good for the olives when they're blossoming. And the point is because the north wind, we said, does not bring very much rain, so therefore it's good for the wheat. Wheat can't grow with too much rain, it'll get flooded. But on the other hand, the olives need a lot of rain in order to get fat and juicy and full of oil. And the other way around, a south wind, which brings lots of rain, is good for the olives when they're blossoming, because now the olives will be very fat and rich. But if such a wind blows when the wheat has grown one third of its growth, then it's not good for it, because again, it means there's too much humidity and it's going to damage the wheat. A way to remember between those two, the north and the south, which one is good for what? Think of Shulchan Bet Safon and Adarim in the Mishkan and the Bes Mikdash. The Shulchan was on the north side, the Menorah was on the south side, so that helps you remember. The Shulchan had bread on it, which is made out of wheat. The Menorah is lit with olive oil. So each kind of wind encourages the growth of the thing that was on that side of the Bes Mikdash. So the north wind helps the grain because the Shulchan was on the north. The south wind helps the olives because the Menorah lit with olive oil was on the south. Anyway, the point is, though, that the earlier part of the Braisa said that just the opposite. An east wind, et cetera, is always good. A west wind is always bad. We're here with the Ashana Ma'arocha. We said the other way around. When there's a west wind, everybody's happy. And when there's an east wind, everybody's sad. And the answer is, like Kasha, Holon, V'holahu. There's a difference between us, meaning in Bavel, because after all, the Gemara Bavli was written in Bavel, versus them in Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, so Rashi explains the difference is, in Bavel is already a very humid country. You know, you look at it nowadays, you look at Iraq as half desert, it doesn't seem like it, but it's low-lying, it used to have lots of canals, most of them are now dried up, but whatever, so therefore, too much humidity and too much rain is not good for it. They already have plenty of water as it is. Yeah, by the way, Psukim that mentioned Bavel as being like that, there's a pasuk that calls Bavel Tsula, which means the swamp. There's other Psukim that imply that Bavel was a well-watered country. So therefore, they don't need more humidity. As opposed to Eretz Yisrael being a mostly mountainous country, it dries up very quickly. It doesn't retain water for very long. So therefore, just the opposite, a west wind that brings more rain and more humidity is good for them. Rabbi Nachman says a little bit differently also. He says also the point is, geographically, Bavel is east of Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, an east wind is going to hit Bavel, is going to come to Bavel more strongly than it will to Eretz Yisrael. So therefore, so in Bavel, an east wind is good for them, whereas in Eretz Yisrael, it's not. And a west wind the other way around, because Bavel, being further east, a west wind has a good effect in Eretz Yisrael, and by the time it reaches Bavel, it's pretty much spent its strength.
The time it talks about the Lord, the Tolem, that's a person that's blowing hot air all the time.
That's also true, but yeah. Okay.
Like
Barishona Perek Shein. The subject of this perek is about the piyosos that they had in the Bes Mikdash. Now, they had four different times during the day. They would have a pious, as we're going to talk about. They would have everybody stand in a circle. Each kohen would stick out one or more fingers, and they would go around the circle and count. And whoever they would pre-designate a number, and whoever the number landed by would be the one to do the next avoda. And then you'd have the people next to him join with him in that avoda, depending how many people there were. They had four of those during the day to decide who gets to do the individual avodas in the Bes Mikdash.
Why is it a circle?
The pious literally means like a lottery or something like that. They it's related it's it's a raffle, whatever. Yeah, it's related to the word pius in the sense that it helps keep the peace among people. Because like this, if you just pick, if the mamuna, if whoever's in charge, just says at random, you're going to do the avodah, everybody else is going to be jealous. Like this, everybody can see that it's done as fairly as possible. There is, by the way, an interesting machlokas rishonim as far as the place of this perek in this Masechta. The Baal Amor writes, even though we have this entire perek over here in Masechta Yoma, which is talking about the piyosis, he says the fact is there were no piyosis on Yom Kippur, because after all, the Kohen Gadol had to do all the avodah. So what piyosis? You don't need to make a pious who's going to do Trumas Adeshin and who's going to burn the Ketoras on the Mizbeach HaPnimi and who's going to clean the Menorah and all the other things, because the Baal Amor says the Kohen Gadol had to do all those things on Yom Kippur. So according to him, the whole perek doesn't really belong in here. It's just once we're talking about the avoda, then it sticks it in. On the other hand, the Ramban strongly disagrees with that. First of all, the Ramban says the fact is you have many piyutim written for Yom Kippur, many sidrei avoda that mention the piyosis. It's hard to say that all those paitonim, some of whom were very great Talmud Chachamim, didn't understand that. And he points out a number of other, and Bechlal, what would the Perek be doing in this Masechta in that case? So the Ramban says, as a matter of fact, if you look in each one of the piyosis, there are in fact things, there are details within that pious that yes, the Kohen Gadol did not have to do that particular avoda. Some other Kohen could do it, and therefore they still need a pious among the Kohenim who are on duty. For example, so the Kohen Gadol has to do the avodas that are special to Yom Kippur, and he has to do all the regular avodas beginning from the shechting of the Korban Tamid. But for example, you still have, there's a pious to see who's going to do Trumas Adeshin, who's going to take the ashes off the Mizbeach. The Ramban says the Kohen Gadol didn't necessarily have to do that. You have a pious where it's true, the pious includes who's going to shech the Korban Tamid and catch the blood and so forth. It's true the Kohen Gadol has to do all those things. But in that pious also, you have, for example, who's going to bring logs of wood onto the Mizbeach. The Kohen Gadol didn't necessarily have to do that. And so he goes further with that, and he explains in detail how each one of the piyosis, there were in fact things that were reserved, that didn't have to be reserved for the Kohen Gadol, and therefore they would do them on Yom Kippur as well. Anyway. The Gemara starts talking about, so again, you have this point, they would have everybody stand in a circle and they would count fingers. So the question is, why do they have to count fingers? Why can't they just count heads? And the answer is, Amar Rabbi Yitzchak, also limnas es Yisrael afilu l'dva mitzvah, because you're not allowed to count Jews directly even for a mitzvah. So they couldn't count heads directly. Shenemar, as we find by Shol, when he's gathering the army and counting the number of soldiers because they're going to go to war against Ammon, the pasuk says vayifkedein bebozek. He numbered them, he counted them in or with bozek. Now the Gemara is understanding that the word bozek comes from a word that means broken pieces. So each person took a shard of earthenware and then they put them in a pile and they counted the shards, and that way they know how many soldiers there are. So you see that Shol didn't count them directly. Now, already in Chumash, you have, of course, you know, where it says at the beginning of Parshas Kisisa that you have to count them with Machzah Shekel, Lo Yibam Negev. But the point is, Maharsha says, there you could argue that that was only a one-time mitzvah because they had done the Chet Egel, and therefore they needed a Kapara. And the Pasuk says, the Machzah Shekel is needed, L'chaper al Nafshei Seichem. In Shol's times, that wasn't necessarily an issue. Therefore, and in later times, when they're doing the pious every day in the Beis Hamikdash, therefore, the Gemara didn't bring that pasuk. Instead, it brought the pasuk from Shol.
There was, they count with Motzi Lechem Menorot, right?
Yeah, there's also the idea of counting. Yeah, Hoshi Yasamech. So it's interesting, there's a sicha where that ever talked about in one of the later years. In older Sfarim, you'll find, and then I think in Machzah Vitri and other Sfarim, you'll find that when they wanted to count people for a minion, they would use the Pasuk V'ani B'roiv Chastaka, because that has 10 words. Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is the first sefer that mentions the idea of using Hashia Samecha. And so the Rebbe said, why is that? Because as we're coming closer to the time of Mashiach, what is Hashia Samecha? Asking Hashem to save the Jewish people. So therefore, so as we come closer to the time of Mashiach, then therefore it became the accepted thing to use that pasuk, that as we're counting people for a minyan, we're meanwhile also together with it davening for Mashiach to come now. Anyway, so the point is, Maharsha says that in fact, not necessarily could you learn from that pasuk in Kisisa that you can't count directly other times, which is why the Gemara needs to bring the pasuk from Shol. There is, by the way, a good deal of discussion about that Ramban in fact says, now we find that David HaMelech made a mistake and counted the people at the end of Sefer Shmuel, and in Divrei Hayamim it tells the story, and there was a terrible plague. So what was David thinking? So in fact, one answer that Ramban says is David thought that exactly like Marsha is saying over here, the mitzvah of not counting them directly. Maybe it was only a one-time thing. Maybe it doesn't apply. Lodertus. So therefore, so that was one idea. Then Amman actually goes into some discussion about it, that and he and other Mephoshim, about what was David's mistake. Was it that he counted them directly? Was it he didn't count them directly? He did use machzah shekel or pieces of earthenware or whatever, like we're saying over here. But the problem was there wasn't a particular good reason for the counting. He just wanted to know how many subjects he has, which is not a valid reason. Whereas he or Shoal is doing it because he has an army and he needs to know how many men there are in the army. So there's some discussion about that. There's Bechlal discussion. What's the reason behind why the Torah says not to count Jews directly anyway? Rashi mentions on the Pasuk, it can bring an Ayin Hara. Rabbeinu Bechaya says the same way as we find the Gemara mentions in some places that a bracha can only be on something that's not measured. Once it's measured, then a bracha can't be chal on it anymore. You want bracha to be chal on the Jewish people. Therefore, you're not allowed to count them. And again, you have this whole discussion of, is there an isser only to count them directly, or is there even an isser to count indirectly, such as through machzah shekel, when you're not doing it for a good, valid purpose, which according to one possibility would be David's mistake. They talk about that, by the way, lahalacha, when they have in Israel nowadays, every 10 years or so, they have a census like they do in most countries. And there's a good deal of discussion among poskim from the 1950s and 60s about the halachas of that. Are you allowed to participate in the census? And they give various, there are rabbonim who have given various haterim for it. Among them, it is l'tzorech, because after all, they need, it's necessary, a government needs to know for statistical purposes how many people there are. It's not an exact count down to the last number. There's always a little bit of uncertainty in it. They're not counting directly because it's all based on forms that were filled out. There are goyish citizens as well. And there's a variety of different points that have been brought up in that connection. Anyway. So here was
probably I asked how many kids he has. Probably you don't count no money, no building, and no kids.
And no kids, yeah. Yeah.
What was the middle one?
They don't count money, buildings, or kids. That's the joke, yeah. Yeah, they say also a joke where a yid is in court, an alta yid, and they need to ask him about, they need to ask him, they're asking him details about his family. So they ask, how many kids do you have? Kanaina Hora 7. Judge says, I don't want to hear this Kanaina Hora. I need just the number. Just answer the question, please. How many kids do you have? Kanaina Hora 7. The lawyer being also a yid and realizes what's going on, he says, you know what, judge, I'll fix this. Kanaina Hora, how many kids do you have? 7. So the point is, the Gemara is assuming that this word bevozek means that he counted them with broken pieces of earthenware or rocks or things like that. However, maskif l'Rabashi, Rabashi says, how do you know? Mimai dahai bezek lishna de bizgahu. How do you know the word bezek means broken pieces? Duma shma de masahu. Maybe it's only the name of a city. So in other words, vayifka de bezek would mean that Shaul counted the soldiers in the city of bezek. Dichkidichtib, as we have at the beginning of Sefer Shoftim, vayimtsu es adoni bezek bevozek. They found adoni bezek in bezek. So that means, in other words, this is when Shevet Yehuda and Shimon are working together to conquer more areas of Eretz Yisrael that hadn't been conquered in Yeshua's times. So they captured the city of Adoni Bezek, and they found the king over there, and his name was Adoni Bezek because he was the master, he was the lord of the city of Bezek. So therefore, so Vayifkadim and Bezek could be the same thing. Elamehoch. Rather, we can answer that we learn it from a different pasuk, also in connection with Shaul, before the war against Amalek. The pasuk says, "Vayishama Shaul asa'am." Shaul gathered the people together. Vayishama literally means he made them hear. He made them hear, because how do you gather people together? You make an announcement, and everybody hears. Anyway, vayifkadim batloim, and he counted them in or with tloim. Now, Tosfos Yeshanim over here points out, on a simple level, tloim is also the name of a city, and in fact, there are mefoshim on the pasuk who say just that. So, in that case, then there's no proof. But the Gemara is assuming that it's not like that the word tloim over here means sheep. So it means, in other words, he had each person takes a sheep out of the king's flock, and then they count the number of sheep, and they know how many soldiers there are. So therefore, you see that he was counting them with sheep rather than directly. So, okay. So Amar Rav Elazar, Kol Amonas Yisrael over Belav. If a person does count Jews directly, then he's over on a lav shenema. You have the pasuk in Heshei at the beginning of the Haftorah of Parshas Devarim. V'hoya mispa b'nei Yisrael k'chol hayom asher layima. The number of the Jewish people will be like the sand of the sea that cannot be measured. So we're understanding, in other words, it's not just that it means, so first of all, okay, you have the fact that you have the Issu in the Torah, again, like we said, that might have been a one-time thing. Here you have a Pasuk in Navi, which is talking for in future times as well. But Marsha says, since it doesn't say Meiroi, it doesn't say Asher LaYiman Meiroi, that would imply that you could count them, but practically speaking, sooner or later, you're going to give up because the number is just too large. You can't bother counting anymore. But since it doesn't say meiroi, the point is not because the number is too large. The point is lo yimad, you're not allowed to measure them. Rav Nachman Yitzchok omer over b'shnei lav, and Rav Nachman Yitzchok says actually a person who counts Jews directly is over on two lav, and shenema asher lo yimad v'lo yisafir, because the pasuk says they can't be measured or counted. So that means, in other words, you're not allowed to estimate, you're not allowed to count directly either. One thing Anaf Yosef, by the way, brings another point over here about why it is taka that counting Jews is no good, is we have the concept al yotzi odim atzim min haklal. A person should always consider himself to be part of the general Jewish people rather than singled out individually. When you're counting individuals, that's what you're doing. You're singling them out individually, and that can cause troubles, because then not necessarily is every person as perfect as he should be, and therefore that brings a kitzur on him and on other Jews as well, Rahman al-Islam. So now in this connection, Amar Rav Shmuel ben Achmeni, Rav Yonasan Rami. Rav Yonasan pointed out a contradiction in that pasuk. K'siv v'hoya mispa b'nei Yisrael k'chol hayom. First it says the number of the Jewish people will be like a sand. Now, the word mispar implies that they have an actual number. But then the pasuk continues that can't be counted, or that can't be measured or counted, implying that there is no number. It's an infinite number. So what is it? Marsha says, according to this, we might say that Rabbi Yonason's point is actually disagreeing with what we said before, that lo yimad v'lo yisafir constitutes a lav not to count them. It's saying as a practical matter, you won't be able to count them because they're numberless. So what is it? And the answer is, like Kasha, kan bizman sha'osin yitzirah v'sonin shamokim. One is when the Jewish people are doing what Hashem wants, then there's no number to them at all. And the other one, the first half of the pasuk, is talking about when the Jewish people are not doing Ritzon Hashem, there'll still be a large number, but not an infinite number.
What was the Bracha Avram got? Like stars in the sky and sand?
Like stars in the sky and like the sand, and like the dust, yeah. So why it is that we're making that distinction between Ritzon Shamakim and not, a number of the Mephoshim discuss over here various possibilities. One of them, Anaf Yosef, brings a point in continuation, since we're saying the danger of counting Jews is then you're singling them out individually, and then not every year is where he should be, Beruchnius. So if everybody is Osin Ritzon Shamakim, then you don't have the problem. So on the contrary, you could argue, if most of the Jews are Rishoyim, then maybe it is better to count them, because then you're singling out Tzadikim. So therefore, that's what we're saying. When Oisin Ritzon Shamakim, then you're not allowed to count them. But when Ein Oisin Ritzon Shamakim, go ahead and count them, because Abdadabba, then you'll be singling out the Tzadikim who will be saved. So that's one point. Eitz Yosef makes a point also that Tzadikim Bechlal, we have a lot of times the concept that one Tzadik is equal to a large number of other people. You have various Gemaras. You have a Gemara that says, for example, that at the battle with Ai, it says that Yorib ben Menashe was killed, and he's equivalent to half the Sanhedrin, to the majority of the Sanhedrin, 36 people. You have a Pasuk that talks about a plague that struck after the people of Beis Shemesh looked at the Arden after it was brought back from the Plishtim, and it says that 70, what does it say over there, 50,000 people were killed in a plague, each one of them equal in caliber to the 70 members of the Sanhedrin. So you have other examples like that. So when Yisrael Oisin Ritzon Shamakim, you can't give a number of Jews, because not just an actual number of actual bodies, you have to consider how much each one is worth, so to speak, in terms of regular people, and that's an incalculable number.
Yeah, that's why it's very important down with the minion, and the whole minion is like kind of forgiven. Hashem,
this is also true, right? This is also true. The Gemara, that's also true. The Gemara mentions elsewhere that Hashem always accepts the tefillah of the Rambam, right? Yeah. Chiddush Gaonim on the here is on the side over here brings another point as well. The same pasuk says that instead of we learned this in Pesachim, Bimkoim, in the place of, instead of that you were called Loy Amiatim, where Hashem says you're not my people. Instead, you're Omalahem Bnei Kelchoy. Hashem will say after they do tshuva, you're the children of the living God. So therefore, in the pasuk itself, you see the difference between Ein Osin Ritzonu Shamakim and Osin Ritzonu Shamakim before they did tshuva and after it. Okay. The Gemara continues, Reb Asi Omer, or Rebbe Omer Mashem Abba Yossi Ben Distoy, Loi Kashe. Here's another answer to answer in the Pasuk, where again, one part of the Pasuk seems to imply that there will be an actual measurable number of Jews, and another one says that it will be incalculable, Kan Bide Adam, Kan Bide Shemayim. Human beings are never going to be able to calculate, but Hashem, who knows all the facts, he'll be able to. Okay. Here's another thing that we can learn from this contrast we said by Shmuel, by Shol. Now the Gemara is going back from what it said before, that maybe the name Bezek is the name of a city rather than meaning broken pieces of earthenware. Now the Gemara is going to go back to the assumption that it does mean that, and it means that Shol counted the Jewish people twice, once with pieces of earthenware, and again, and another time with sheep. So therefore, once a person is appointed a leader over the tzibur, miyad misasher, right away he becomes rich. And we see that in the Ikruk, and the reason for that, there's a number of reasons why, because now his mazel is greater. There's the idea that this way people don't think that he enriched himself from the public, because they see that right away he becomes rich. So everybody realizes it's because of his mazel. It's because now he has the whole tzibur behind him. It's because it's more respectable that the tzibur should be led by somebody rich. And there's a number of different reasons. Anyway, because look what happened with Shaul. The first time, when he's taking the army to fight against Ammon, and at that point, not everybody had accepted him as king yet, you have in the Pesukim in Shmuel that describes he had already been anointed as king by Shmuel, but not everybody accepted him yet as king. Many people were saying, by Yivzuhu, the pasuk said, they were mocking him and saying, Maya Shienu Zer, how does this guy think he can help us? Only now, when Nochosh Melech Bnei Ammon is threatening the city of Yavish Gilad, and they appeal to Shaul for help, and he brings out the army to help him out, after that, then everybody accepted Shaul as king. That's it. You have at the beginning of the Haftarah of Korach, by Yom Shmuel, L'chuv Neelcha al Gilgal, L'chadesh Shem Amlocha, let's go to Gilgal and renew the kingship. Renew, meaning in other words, now that everybody is agreeable that Shaul should be the king, now we're going to have a new coronation ceremony because the other one was incomplete. The point is, so now when we're going to war now against Ammon, Shaul is not fully accepted as king yet. By the time they went to war against Amalek, he's already fully accepted as king. And we see the first time, he has to count them with shards of earthenware because they can't afford anything better. The second time, already he's so rich that he has so many sheep that he's able to have every person take a sheep out of the king's flock, and then they can count the sheep. So the Gemara says, "V'dum atloim didhu." So first it says, "V'yifkanim abazik lovasayfti v'yifkanim atloim." The Gemara asks one, but who says the sheep belong to the king? V'dum atloim didhu. Maybe it means their own sheep. Maybe he tells each person, "Bring your own sheep, and we'll count them." And the Gemara answers, "Okay, my rabusa de milsa." Then what's the chiddush? Then why does the pasuk even need to bother mentioning the v'yifkanim abazik and v'yifkanim atloim? It must be in order to. So fine, one of them we need to be told that he followed the halacha and counted them only with other things rather than directly. But we don't need twice to be told. So we could have just said the second time by Yifkadim, and we'd also understood that he did it with some object. The reason why it mentions Batloim is to stress this point that he became rich and now he can afford to give everybody a sheep out of his flock for them to count with. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola, Chavdalad Cheshvan. So there's talking more about Tfias HaMesim, we started talking about yesterday about the avoider that we do nowadays that brings to Tfias HaMesim. So now you have the Medrash has the expression that the way a person goes is the way he comes back by Tfias HaMesim. If he passed away blind, then he comes out by Tchias HaMesim blind, and then Hashem heals him afterwards. It says elsewhere. If he went dressed, then he comes back dressed in Tachrichim. Now that applies when we say Holach Lobush Ba Lobush. That also applies to a person's it means two different things. So. It can mean the garments that he went into the grave with, his tachrichim, that he wakes up with those tachrichim. It can also mean the kind of clothing that he regularly wore while he's alive, that he'll be clothed in that la'asid lovely. The first, the Rebbe in a letter over there goes and elaborates more on this point. One thing is, according to the opinion, that it means tachrichim. The Gemara mentions in Nida that you have from that the concept mitzvahs of Taylor law said lavoi, and therefore that you're allowed to bury a mess in tachrichim made out of shatnez, because it doesn't matter when they come alive. But tchesem mesim, they won't be bound by that mitzvah any. Starting new simon in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, the dinim of Hadlokas HaNeiros, simon Ayin Hei. So, a person has to stop working and then light candles, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch says, at least half an hour before Tzeitzik HaChavim. The Alter Rebbe phrases it differently. In Seder Achnasas Shabbos, the Alter Rebbe says you have to light when the sun is shining at the tops of the trees, and it's going to be anywhere between an hour and 2 hours before Tzeitzik HaChavim in the northern countries, in Russia and Belarus and whatever, where the Alter Rebbe live. For us, we look on the calendars and we see what time it is. It usually comes out around an hour or a little bit less before Tzeitzik HaChavim.
So when the sirens go off over here, the last siren, what is that?
The last siren is, I think, 2 minutes before Lichten. And the first one is, I think, 10 minutes before, and the second one is 2 minutes before.
So that covers all the opinions?
So that's following the Alter Rebbe's opinion, yeah. Now, if they say in Shul, Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, or the Alter Rebbe adds, now Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos is the official acceptance of Shabbos. The Alter Rebbe says it's not actually Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, it would actually be Baruch Hu. But be that as it may, when they say that point, even if it's still a long time until, even if it's still even if it's still 2 hours before Tzeitzik HaChavim, or the Alter Rebbe says, even if it's Plaga Mincha and on, which is an hour and a quarter before, then Shabbos is Chal on the minority, and they're also in Ol Melacha. Now, practically speaking, for example, when you're, let's say, in Crown Heights, you don't have that. Even if you have, you may have a particular shul where they daven early, so if you daven in that shul, then you're bound by that, but of course not everybody else in town is. But on the other hand, if you're in one of these Favorfina places where they only have one shul in the community, then yes, you're bound by what they do. And if they daven Friday night early, then you're bound by that, even if you're not going to be davening there for whatever reason. That's a practical thing to know when you're out of town. And yeah, even if you come from another town, when they say Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, or according to the Alter Rebbe, when they say Baruch Hu, then at that point Shabbos is Chal on you. On the other hand, if there are two shuls in town, then one of them does not have to follow the other.
Can I call it whatever shul you're davening, and you have to go along with whatever they're doing, the midhav and all that?
In general, yes. So here we're talking about particularly if you're going to be davening in a shul, like here in Crown Heights, you have during the summer, there's the shul, as they call it, on Albany, where they take in Shabbos early, and they daven in early Maariv. So if you daven over there, then yes, you and your family are bound by that, and you have to light, and then your wife would have to light before they say Mizmor Shir L'Yom HaShabbos, or Baruch Hu, as the case may be. But on the other hand, if you daven in a different shul, you're not bound by that. But yeah, if you're in one of these towns where they only have one shul, then yeah, you have to pay attention to what their davening time is, because you're nigra after that, even if for whatever reason you're not going to be davening there.
I have to repeat the Shema.
That's another matter. You might have to repeat the Shema after it says, but that's another matter.
Okay, good.
Okay.